So, and we're back. And we're now here with Jose Rivera and Chris Hertel. The other way around, okay, with Chris Rivera and Jose Hertel talking about fresh, what's Spargel? You know, something.
See, is that okay? All you people in the back. Is it my breath? Is it my breath? You can tell me. Come on. Okay, I don't bite. He bites, but I don't bite. All right, I'm going to do this even lower. I really am. Because, honestly, I'm just too freaking loud. You want to switch up? There we go. You thought I was joking. Everybody ready? All right. Quick. Before we start, I just want to show this off. You remember they were handing out like old t-shirts last year? They were extras from previous years. Big sizes, triple XL, that kind of thing. I made a pillowcase. All right, let's go.
Recycling in action.
Samba on Gloucester, the things we do for love. So that's me, I'm Chris, he's Jose. Go back a sec. Anybody ever get songs in their heads when they're working on this? I get songs in my head when I'm working on slides. So this one here is the Beatles singing, "Hey, you know, your boy, you're gonna carry that weight," you know, that one. And then The Things We Do For Love, that's a song. That's a 10cc, wasn't it? And then Just Enjoy the Ride, anybody here of Mortiba? That's a current band, I think. They did that song. Anyway, go ahead. All right, again. Another song, Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. If you don't know me by now, how many people have never seen me give a presentation before? I got one, and one joker here. All right, so you don't need to hear this. Go ahead, Jose, who are you?
I'm the other guy.
Yeah.
This is all your fault.
This is all our fault. And we both work for Red Hat these days. Prior to that, we were our own little company, and for those who are not aware, most of you are, we actually got hired by Microsoft to write the specifications for SMB SIFs, which is kind of freaky when you think about it. Pardon? Yes, yes,
thank
I'm
you.
Still recovering,
thank you.
And so is he. And you, of course. We have to acknowledge our audience here. I see most of you, actually, from the picture. Okay, real quick overview of what we're gonna talk about. I wanna make sure that we have foundation here, basic stuff. I worked for 10 years at the University of Minnesota, so I have a bit of a teaching background because I used to volunteer to teach different courses. So we're gonna cover briefly metadata and semantics. You can go to sleep now, Volker. Basically, the idea of semantic translation. The Samba VFS layer, CTDB, we're gonna touch on all those things. Then we'll go over the basics of Gloucester and what happens when we put all this together. Okay, and then some room for questions. So let's get going. And again. So metadata, I looked that up on Wikipedia just to be sure. Data about data, right? Information about the piece of information you have. When you transfer a file, anybody remember FTP? People remember? Oh, I got some people remember FTP, right? You're transferring two things. Transferring the bits of your file, and then you transfer the name. Maybe you'd give it a new name on the other end, actually. You could do that. Another piece of information that got transferred was the file size, right? But you were just thinking, I'm transferring the data, right? That's what I used to think anyway when I was just starting out. I'm transferring data. X modem, Y modem, Z modem, transferring data. I forgot that there was additional information there, right? I'd transfer a file and the permissions bits would be different. The things I could do with it would be different. I'd have to change it to get it right, to get it to the way I wanted it. And that was one of the big problems, for example, for the Macintosh. When you were, the old Macintosh, I don't know if they still do this, but they had these forks, Okay, there was the data fork and the resource fork, and the resource fork was more metadata. And when you transferred the file over something like FTP, a protocol that wasn't written with the Mac in mind, you either had to bundle up your file in a special container, or you were only transferring the data fork. Right? So the kinds of things that are metadata, path names, inode numbers. Okay, inode numbers seem like an innocuous little thing, but there are more and more systems out there that absolutely require not only a unique identifier, a numeric identifier for a file, but also require that that unique identifier survive for a longer period of time. All right. Timestamps. Windows uses different timestamps than we do. Different semantics on the timestamps, different rules on the timestamps. DOS had a 2-second resolution. Not one, two. All right. Permissions, access controls, file size, and quotas. File size is also an interesting one because you think, okay, this file has 12 bytes in it, right? 12-byte file, right? But how much is actually allocated on the disk? That depends on the file system. And under Windows, you can say when you create a file, you can say, I want to pre-allocate this much space. I want this much space pre-allocated for my file. So file size changes. Quota handling changes. These are all things that are about the files you've got. Quota is another interesting one because it's not about a file. It's about all your files. So your individual file has a part in that. But then there are other files out there, you know, that you also own that also play into the quota management, right? Metadata identifies files, current state, sets limits. Limits are important. Okay. The semantics of the meaning of the metadata. Okay, you can have a number associated with a file. Is that number the size? Is that number the last modified time? Is that number some fingerprint, hash mark, you know, hash of some sort? Is it a pointer to the next node in the linked list of parts of the, depending on how you store your file, right? So each piece of metadata has with it a context. What does it mean? And a set of rules for interpreting and manipulating it. Think of it as an object. Each piece of metadata is, in a sense, its own object, related to the bigger object, which is the whole file. Right? And the whole file includes the metadata. You have to enforce the set limits. You have to enforce permissions. And you have to have a reasonable assurance of correctness so that you don't have problems. For example, if you have a permission system and you don't have some mechanism for enforcing those permissions that works, then you can get around those permissions and do things to the file that maybe somebody didn't want you to do in the first place, right? And all those semantic rules are actually handled by, supported by, enforced by the operating system, and the file system is, you know, connected into the operating system, so they work together to set, manage, and enforce those rules. Go ahead. So here's where we get interesting in terms of Samba. People say Samba is an SMB file server. And I tend to say, well, yeah, okay, maybe. But it's also, and probably its bigger job, it's also a semantic translator. Okay, it takes all these rules and understanding of Windows environments, right? And it then finds ways to apply them on the Linux or BSD or whatever server platform that Samba's running on, and in addition, translate them down so that they are respected by the local system. Okay? So a good example, the one I've been working with recently, is byte range walks. Windows has a completely different semantic set for byte range walks. Okay? So Samba actually has its own database, a TDB, or in a clustered environment, a CTDB database, that keeps track of all of the Windows byte range locks so that we can handle them correctly for SMB semantics. But at the same time, Samba also passes through with a POSIX byte range lock, an FCN tail lock, so that the file system knows that there's a lock on a range of bytes and can report it when another process comes along, an NFS server, for example, or whatever else is running, and says, hey, I want to lock that range of bytes. So we not only respect the Windows semantics, but we now also provide the POSIX semantics. And this happens a lot in Samba. Okay? This happens, user IDs, user identification. It's another area where this happens. And a lot of translation has to go on, and state for two systems has to be maintained. All right? Down here, Samba is on the server talking to the file system. Right? What Samba is expecting is that the underlying file system will behave the way that Samba thinks a local file system should behave. Right? There are basic rules for that. POSIX semantics. POSIX rules on file systems, right? So the idea is that Samba is going to make a call and get a result back that it expects. And if that rule is broken, then just as if this other rule, this SMB rule, got to behave the way SMB expects, if this other rule is broken, you got a problem just as if we messed up the protocol, right? Okay. So, as I said, if Samba, you know, if we mess up the protocol, it's a bug. And we get all sorts of email on Samba Technical and bug reports and Bugzilla and people wringing their hands and wailing to the, you know, it's bad. It's a problem. Every time a new version of Windows comes out, we get a little bit of this because things change and we have to adapt. If we're ahead of the curve, then that's great. And if we're not, now, these days it's a lot easier to be ahead of the curve, but back in the NT time frame and the Windows 2000 time frame, a change would come out and we're like, oh, great, now we've got to go figure this out and fix it. And similarly, again, if the file system does not properly handle the semantics of a POSIX file system, we have an expectation that there will be trouble from that. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, look at that. He did it. So if you're looking for dragons, you know, there be dragons. If you're looking for dragons, if you're looking for trouble, this is where it's going to happen, in all those translation layers. All right. There are other things that go on. You know, Volker gave a nice talk this morning about performance and performance capabilities, and that's very important. But before I get to performance, I want, does it work? Okay. More important even than that, will I mangle my user's data? Is there a chance that I could mangle my user's data? Because if there is, I don't want it. Right? I'm not ready to push if that's going to a possibility. Okay. There's some birds. So the Samba VFS layer. This is an important piece in handling semantic translation. One of the things you can do, for example, is there are VFS modules you can plug in that if you know your file system has support for extended attributes, you can plug in a new VFS module, and boom, now you have Windows ACLs handled in extended attributes. It's a nice thing. It's a nice feature. Okay? It's something you can add if you know that the file system underneath your installation has support for that feature. And many of them do now. Here's the conceptual layering of, you know, the way things happen in Samba. Again, conceptual. SMB messages are received and parsed. You have to do that first. You have to know what the heck message you've got. Did I get a read command? Did I get an open? Non-file system commands, things that don't have to go down to the file system, can be handled in other code. Sometimes there's a plug-in in the back end, for example, for authentication. Or sometimes, you know, it's something else that the client has asked to have done, and it doesn't involve the file system. There are a few of those. But most things go through what we call the VFS layer. It's originally created by Tim Potter, I believe, way back in the Samba 2 days, and has been hammered on since by several people. The final module, now notice I have a dashed line here. You can put in, here's the default VFS module, right? But you can put other ones in between if you want, and thereby add different features, stack them on top of each other. So Samba's file system commands call the VFS layer. The VFS layer calls the modules down below. One thing that can happen, for example, if you have a stack of VFS modules, one of them can say, I'm going to skip all the way to the end, or it can say, I'm stopping here and I'm going to return. So you can bypass things you don't want in layers below. Okay? But the other thing you can do, and this was exemplified, Richard's not here, is he? Okay, he's probably in the other room. Richard Sharp did a really nice job a while back of putting together a VFS module for the Ceph file system. There are a couple of examples that go before that. Isilon did one for their OneFS file system. So they're bigger and smaller. There's a GPFS module in there. In the source directories under modules, you'll find a whole bunch of example VFS modules, and you can pick and choose which ones are appropriate for your use. One of the things about Ceph and one of the things about Gluster, which is what I work on, is that it is not, you don't have to actually mount it as a file system. Because it's designed with Fuse in mind, you can have a userland daemon running that's doing all the real work, right, and then doing I.O. below it, and then it goes through the kernel to the Fuse system, and then you mount you do a Fuse mount to mount that, right? Well, we can bypass all that by going directly to the libraries, okay? If you do that, though, you have to remember that you can't call down anymore. You have to break the stack because anything below is expecting an underlying file system, and there is none. There's no underlying file system, right? Because you haven't mounted it. You're going through a library to get to the data you want to get. Thank you. And Samba's flexible. What the VFS module does for us is that whole semantic translation between Samba and the POSIX file system, we can fiddle with that now. We have access to that. We can make changes in how we behave. Volker, again, this morning, did a nice example, one that we've just seen ourselves. We had this real problem, a real bottleneck, having speed problems. And part of the problem was that we were doing multiple lookups for the same file name. So if you have a file name foo, F-O-O, right, that's three alphabetic characters. If you're going to make sure you don't have a collision on the server side, remember Windows is case insensitive, so it doesn't care. If you're going to make sure that you're not going to have a collision on the server side, you have to go through all the possible combinations of upper lower case. Now that would be 2 to the 3rd, because there are 3 characters to work with, right? So that's 8. Short name like foo has 8. Add one more character, one more letter, okay, and now you have 16. Okay, see where the problem comes in? So you can bypass limitations of the underlying file system. You can work around bugs. You can take advantage of features in an underlying file system. You can tune for speed all in the VFS layer. You can find ways to bypass problems, cache things if you need to. There are ways you can tune for speed, and there's more you can do with it. So let's talk about Gluster. Okay? Everybody with me so far, this is fairly easy stuff, right? Everybody's happy? Okay. So Gluster, this is pretty brief too. Here we have 4 machines. Each machine has its own hard drives, right? Typically, we create a back-end network, a front-end network. The file system talks to itself across the back-end network. So each node has a daemon running on it, and that daemon is talking to all the other nodes. And they usually do that on a back-end network. Because in the front-end network, we're talking to our clients. We're talking to our customers. Okay? On each node, you create a directory on some big chunk of storage that you're going to share out. And you create subdirectories in that. And each subdirectory can be a separate brick, part of a separate brick. So you carve out space just by creating a subdirectory and assigning that subdirectory as part of a brick. A brick is a collection of subdirectories across the nodes, one from each node, all right, where we're actually going to store the data. Bricks are bound together, and when they're put together, they're called volumes. So a volume is what you see on the front end. You look and say, oh, I see a storage space, a directory I can mount, via fuse in this case. I can mount that directory, and then I will have a space. What's really happening, though, is you're mounting this fuse object, which goes to the daemon, and that daemon separates out where it's actually storing the data you give it, the files you give it. Okay? The volumes can be distributed and or replicated. So you could have a system where you set it out so that you're using all of your disk space, you're just distributing where the files get stored across your cluster here. Or you can turn on replication, which is mirroring basically, and then you'll have essentially a two and two kind of a situation where a given pair of, a given file is stored on two machines. All right, it's got a major, a main copy and a secondary copy. They're not really secondary, they're both equal. It's active-active, so they're both equal. And then the next thing is that these volumes that we've created can be made available via what are called access methods. And access methods are simple stuff. You can do the fuse mount. You can run Samba on top of the fuse mount. You can run NFS as an NFS v3 piece that's built right into Gluster. There's UFO. There's Swift. There are a few other things that we build on top of Gluster as access methods. Okay? Next. So the fuse mount is just another access method. Fuse is just one of the ways to get into Gluster. The client can be local or remote. Very often, when you build a Gluster cluster, you're running the, you take the daemons, so the servers, and they go through locally, and you mount, do fuse mounts on the local machine, and then run something like Samba or some other access method on top of the fuse mount. And that way it's all still on the server. But there's a lot of traffic then within the server. Another thing you can do, if you really want access to this and you're just doing busy work yourself, you've got a workstation, you're doing a lot of stuff that requires big storage, you can do the fuse mount remotely. You can do it over network link, okay, so that you can directly access the Gluster storage. You don't need NFS and you don't need SMB. It's got a native protocol. Samba, up until recently, has always run on top of the fuse mount point. Okay, so Samba will run on top of the fuse mount point, which then talks to the daemon, which then talks to the storage. Yeah, okay, next. Winter in Minnesota, go ahead. So Samba and Gluster and Fuse. All right, this is where we put all these pieces together. Everybody's fascinated. You have to connect the Gesinta to the torque defibrillator and make sure the comparator cuff is on. And then that comes, anyway. Whoops, go back. Yeah, okay, that's fine, go ahead. So I said before, as we said already, Samba is a semantic translation engine, right? It translates semantics, and then it translates them again, and then it translates them all the way back. And that's the busy work it's doing. I just want to take a side note here and say that Windows does this too. If you look at what Windows does with SMB1, not with SMB2 anymore, thankfully, but with SMB1, DOS and OS2 semantics are supported. DOS and OS2 semantics are in the protocol, and so a Windows server has to do the same kind of translation. It has to translate to and from OS2 expectations or DOS expectations. So this is not unique by any means. And Samba expects this, the POSIX behaviors below it. The two that I'm most interested in here for today are read-write coherency, cache coherency, and POSIX byte range locking support. Correct, POSIX byte range locking support. There are a couple of other things we want. We want the extended attributes. We like POSIX ACLs. We like to have POSIX ACLs. It would be nice if someday we could get rich ACLs into the kernel, because rich ACLs would support a vast variety of different systems, Windows, NFS v4, and the POSIX kind of stuff. But that's been talked about, I think, for 8 years now or more. and hasn't happened yet. Pardon?
If you get something like that, probably ACI is across NFS for ACI is also different than which ACI is. There are some bugs in there that wouldn't be addressed by which ACI is as well.
Right, it's an approximation. Rich ACLs is just an approximation. It's just the best approximation we've got. So, yeah. Gluster is also adaptable and cool. You can add things to Gluster. Gluster is built in layers just like Samba is. They're, instead of VFS modules, Gluster comes the other direction, has what are called translators. And you can plug in a new translator and add a new feature. All right. Gluster also hides things that are going on the actual disk, in the actual directories. So there are a number of things you could do that would improve Samba's ability to work with Gluster. For example, we could put Windows ACLs right into the file system. We don't have to store it in an EA if we don't want to. We could. I mean, that's one place to put it. But we can actually put the support for, that's the point. We can put the support for, thank you, the support for the Windows ACLs right into a translator in Gluster. And that way, the permissions checking happens in the file system, not in Samba, where you have a potential race condition. Oplocks and leases, Windows timestamps, all that can be handled at the Gluster layer and not have to touch the kernel file system. So the translators are stacked very much like Samba VFS modules. So there are a lot of possibilities to explore here. I don't have any particular plans, but the door is open. Go ahead. But Fuse presents a problem for us. It's a generic mount point, and it hides things. Gluster can't see what's going on in Samba. Samba can't see what's going on in Gluster. All right? So we have a standard interface, which is great, but it hides things in both directions. Go ahead. And what happened as a result of that, after I think years actually, because I think the first time I heard about this idea was from John Terpstra about 2 years ago. Finally we got, thanks to Jeremy and to Anand Devadi, who is also in Mountain View and is part of Red Hat, we have a Gluster VFS now. It's a starting point, it's brand new. We're trying to first make it stable so we can ship it, and then we'll add all sorts of features. It's similar to the Ceph one, the one that the Ceph folks put out, Richard Sharp in particular. When it actually came time to do this, when somebody finally said, well, okay, I'll go ahead and do this and I'll sit down and write this, partially because Jeremy was there and Jeremy knows the VFS layer, and partially because the guy who wrote it really knows the libgf API, the Gluster interface library, it took less than a week to actually put this together. You know, and part of that, you know, too, is plenty of examples. There are plenty of example code out there for people to look at and try this. Go ahead. But now we add one more thing to the mix before we're done. CTDB. CTDB, right now, if you do Ceph, for example, you can run Samba on a single Ceph node. Ceph is a distributed file system, but they don't yet integrate with CTDB. So you can run Ceph on a single, Samba on a single node and have SMB access to your cluster, and that's cool. But if that node goes down, then you have to move and restart Samba on another node, and then you can reconnect, and it's kind of not so clean. We've already started working, we've already got CTDB working, basically. CTDB is a distributed metadata database. Remember at the very beginning I talked about metadata? If you're running a cluster, each Samba node needs to know what the other Samba nodes know. Byte range locks, permissions, things like that, all have to be shared. Okay? So CTDB gives us that capability to share that information. CTDB also has a heartbeat mechanism to detect node failures and a recovery mechanism associated with that. And then during the recovery, the other thing it can do is move an IP address from one node to another, so that when a client reconnects, it's reconnecting to an active node. So CTDB allows multiple Samba servers. They can all actively share the same share off of a cluster. This is one of my favorites because I drew it by hand. The thing is, I'll just point this out, we have Gluster forming a cluster here, right? We also have CTDB forming a cluster up there. This was drawn originally by one of the product managers at Red Hat. He said, why do I have two clusters? Okay. And it's, to some extent, that's a good question. You know, there are things CTDB does for Samba that are really cool. And the things that Gluster does, but they're both cluster systems. They're both, you know, sharing data across the cluster. One of the things about that, though, is that let's say you wanted to have the Samba services two and two. You could do that. Two Samba servers sharing out one set of shares, another set of two Samba servers sharing out another set of shares. You could do that in this configuration. Okay? My daughter's in India this year. Okay, so what we found. Jose, you're on.
How are we doing for time?
Well, you're still in the 5 minutes.
All right. POSIX byte range locking. Chris found this wonderful quote from earlier this year. Unless your cluster file system is called GPFS, locking is probably completely broken and should be avoided. This was true. We managed to, the first thing we did was run the good old ping pong test, and we got a bunch, and it was failing. It was, and I think it was failing on a single node.
It usually failed on a single node. But that's only the symptom.
Yeah, that was just a symptom. We managed to track it down to a bug where some function was returning a bad return value.
Cheers to Michael Adam, who actually pinpointed it for us.
Thank you, Michael.
Basically, what was happening was the fgetlock request basically says, do I have access to this byte range now? And the answer was coming back, no, you've got a lock on it.
Oops.
That's the wrong answer.
All right.
Is it mine? No, it's yours.
All right, cache coherency. Once we got past the locking bug, we managed to get ping pong to run, but once it was running, it wasn't returning back coherent values. You would start putting in new instances of ping pong, which basically expects to report how many instances of ping pong are running. Yeah?
So are you testing ping pong tests on Gluster, or are you testing it through SMB clients?
Both.
We are using the native ping pong test on Gluster,
okay.
And we are using SMB ping pong from the SMB torture suite.
Okay,
yeah. We are not using, and this was a problem we had. This is a problem that you have to be aware of. If you use the SIFS mount point in Linux and try to run tests on top of that, you need to know what you're doing, because the SIFS client also has some issues with things like coherency. And you need to know that they're there, and you have to turn on a strict mode.
Right.
You have to turn on the strict mode, otherwise.
And that's the default mainline browser.
It is now.
Yeah, but at the time, RHEL says it was not.
Right. So we have this issue that you want to be careful what client you're using, and you want to know very well what your client's going to do. The other thing about using the Linux SIFS client is when it negotiates SMB, the versions we're using, again, we're in RHEL 6 land, negotiates SMB1, and then if it's talking to a Samba server, says, oh, and you're a Samba server, let's talk about doing the Unix extensions. So the bottom line is you're talking a different language, right? You're not speaking regular SMB anyway. And then you're not doing a test that emulates the behavior of Microsoft Office products, right? So the behaviors you get on the wire are going to be different. So knowing what you're testing with and what you should be testing with, that's important. That's an important step.
Right, and then CTDB node banning. This is a relatively new one. Under heavy load from our favorite little FSCT tool, CTDB permanently bans a running node. We don't know why yet, but it may be related to a known and recently fixed bug in the version of CTDB we're testing. Thank you, Michael.
Okay.
Well, I'm currently looking into probably related issues.
Well, then we should be in touch.
Yes. Definitely.
Okay, good.
Slow directory lookups. As he mentioned, Windows is case insensitive. POSIX is case sensitive. This causes problems. In particular, fuse calls to getDents were taking a very long time. Something like, I think it was 12 times slower than
On the order of 2 milliseconds.
And
When you have four or 5,000 of those calls, it adds up.
Yeah. So we solved this by not using Fuse. That was one of our main motivators. So it was the VFS module should prove a significant performance gain.
Fuse, newer versions of Fuse use a newer version of something called ReadDir inside. They use ReadDir Plus, and that would also bypass this problem. But the version of Fuse that we're shipping does not have that fix in it. And since it doesn't have that fix, the easier solution is to use the VFS cluster linkage to bypass the problem. Okay?
And that's it. Any questions?
Yeah, Tom.
In the previous slide, you said POSIX is case sensitive. That's actually not true. POSIX file systems have a case sensitive and case preserving attribute. So I assume you're saying that the cluster FS or cluster fuse library is not case sensitive. Why don't you just change that library?
Well, that's another option, as I pointed out in the earlier slides. Gluster uses typically in our shipment.
It's an option, but why aren't you doing it?
Because we haven't gotten there yet.
Oh, right.
Okay. But, I mean, this is a problem we found, a month ago?
Yep.
And we've been tracking it down and trying to get the right people. And besides, we bypassed it. Generally on a bullet point on a slide, I've abbreviated things.
Yeah, okay. But
generally speaking, on a Linux system, if you type file name FOO, capital FOO is your file name, and you create another file, lowercase FOO, you can create both. Right. They're different. They're case sensitive in that sense.
Right. So, okay. Let me be more specific. So the reason most POSIX file systems do that is because most POSIX file systems do that.
Right.
Therefore, the applications expect this.
Right.
Kind of doesn't have a lot of legacy, right?
Right.
So maybe there's an opportunity here?
The opportunity would be that we could make a case-insensitive file system. True. Typically, we run on top of, remember it's a daemon actually running on top of a real file system. And the real file system is typically ext4 or XFS, preferably XFS.
Oh. Cluster's layered on somebody else's storage.
Right.
Yep.
Right, there you go.
So we don't have our own legacy, we have somebody else's to deal with.
Right, but that doesn't preclude us from creating a case-insensitive index within the cluster layer.
Sure, more code, what the hell. So, I don't know much about cluster, does it store files, not with the file name that it presents?
Yeah.
Through its API, it does store the file.
Yeah,
file.
Yeah.
Okay, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I know.
Michael?
And the work has to be done either way, right? You've got to do the lookup anyway to figure out where this thing is. It doesn't seem like it would be that hard to have a layer of indirection.
Go ahead and shut down. We're going to get the next guy up.
I don't know. I'm bike shedding now. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, this is all good stuff. We can talk later real quickly. Right. That's exactly what we're doing. Yeah.
But the guy at the bottom of the stack has to do it, not the guy in the middle of the stack. Right.
The file system lives at the cluster layer. The file system lives at the cluster layer. We're just using XFS.
Maybe you can do it more efficiently than anybody else at the top.
Efficiently is not what I'm saying.
Well, but that's the problem, right?
Cluster is aiming at scalability first.
All right, gentlemen, take it offline. We're being shuffled offstage, so thank you very much.